This is Kathy coming to you with the Decatur Herald and Review for Wednesday, May the 27th, and the headline on the front page, Illinois sends its soybean crop away. Infrastructure limits market conditions challenge growers. Inside a factory on Chicago's north side, the smell of simmering soybeans drifts through the air. On a typical day, I use about 4,000 pounds of dry beans, Jenny Yang said. She and her team grind, cook, and press thousands of pounds of soybeans into silky tofu and rich soy milk, the taste of home for Yang and for many who grew up with tofu on the table. She still makes it the same way, no preservatives, made mostly by hand, said Bob Lum, a longtime friend of Yang who helps with the business. Her company, Phoenix Bean, has been making tofu and soy milk this way since she bought it in 2006. It's one of the few businesses in the state that uses Illinois food-grade non-GMO or non-genetically modified organism soybeans, sourced directly from local farms like Janie's Mill in Ashcombe. I know them since back in the day, like at least 10, 15 years, Yang said. This is a good, very good partnership. Illinois grows more soybeans than any other state, harvesting more than 639 million bushels in 2025, way ahead of Iowa's 595,000 million bushels and Minnesota's 371 million bushels. Lawmakers designated the soybean as the official state bean in 2025, effective January 21st, 2026, was Senator Doris Turner, Democrat of Springfield, who chairs the Senate Agriculture Committee, calling Decatur the soybean capital of the world. But almost none of those millions of bushels end up as food on Illinois plates. According to the Illinois Soybean Association, 60% of the soybeans grown in the state are exported. Most of the remaining 40% are processed as animal feed, leaving the state reliant on imports for its soy food. 95% of the food consumed in the state of Illinois is imported, said Representative Sonia Harper, Democrat of Chicago, chair of the House Agricultural and Conservation Committee, speaking of Illinois food crops. If there were any type of natural disaster, Illinois only has enough food that will last us for 3 days. In 2025, with the trade war freezing exports to China, one of the biggest buyers of Illinois soybeans, Governor J.B. Pritzker declared an agricultural export crisis on October 29th and directed state agencies to enhance domestic markets. For farmers and food producers, the pressure has made the need for local infrastructure more urgent than ever, raising the question of whether more of Illinois' own crops, especially soybeans, can finally start feeding more Illinoisans. Harper said more effort and massive investment are needed. She sponsored the Local Food Infrastructure Grant Program, which provides local farmers with small grants for processing, storage, and distribution. She worked closely with the Illinois Stewardship Alliance, a policy advocate for local food and farm communities, to build legislative momentum. "We have some of the best soil, the best farmland," Harper said. "No matter where you are, urban, suburban, and rural, we need to be producing more food in the state." She described local food production as a win-win that will help create jobs and generate revenue. Her downstate colleague, Representative Charlie Meyer, Republican of Okawville, a farmer himself who raises about 1,000 acres of soybeans every year, noted that the farmers follow price signals. "We are very conservative, and we do everything the same," Meyer said. "But at the same time, we must be able to change everything in the drop of a second, and we will go wherever the markets are." For Illinois farmers, the math is brutal. Food-grade soybeans require older genetics that yield 10 to 15 fewer bushels per acre. Jeff O'Connor, a northern Illinois farmer who has grown food-grade soybeans, said his commodity soybeans averaged in the low 70s bushels per acre last year. His food-grade soybeans, which uses varieties more than a decade older, yielded in the low 60s. Weed control is another issue. Unlike commodity soy, which allows for certain herbicides, food-grade soybeans are non-GMOs, so farmers can't use any of those chemicals. Furthermore, fields often look unkempt. "You can't do that again," one landowner told O'Connor after a season of raising food-grade soybeans. "I don't care if we made a little more money. They look terrible." O'Connor, who's been growing food-grade beans for large buyers like Danone, is planting none this year. In 2025, the premium for non-GMO food-grade soybeans averaged $2.53 per bushel on top of the $10.50 commodity soybeans price, bringing the total to approximately $13.03 per bushel. But that extra money, he said, no longer offsets the lower yield, the extra labor, the equipment cleaning, storage segregation, and the weed pressure. For many Illinois farmers, switching from commodity soybeans to food-grade soybeans remains a hard sell. The math is reflected across Illinois. Todd Main, the Director of Market Development for the Illinois Soybean Association, confirmed this tension. While food-grade soybeans are a fast-growing sector, it's a relatively small portion of the overall market. Is it fast-growing? Yes, he said, but in volume, not so much. Main pointed to the longer-term shifts in global demand. Despite the ongoing crisis with China's market shrinking, he noted that the association has been exploring new markets in Africa, Southeast Asia, and India for soybean exports. But those new trade relationships can take years to build. Under the trade truce announced at the Busan summit in the late 2025, China pledged to purchase 12 million metric tons of U.S. soybeans by year's end, with annual targets of 25 million metric tons through 2028. Now, with the truce remaining in effect, no formal long-term purchase agreement has been signed. Returning from a summit to Beijing earlier this month, President Donald Trump said the farmers are going to be very happy. They, China, is going to be buying billions of dollars of soybeans, he said. The White House said China had agreed to buy at least $17 billion of U.S. agricultural products annually through 2028, on top of those soybean commitments. Beijing has not publicly confirmed that figure. The lack of a stable export outlook has highlighted the need for better local infrastructure. Main pointed to a specific priority, bridges. An efficient network of roads, rails, and waterways has long been the competitive advantage for U.S. soy in global markets. About 30% of county bridges in Illinois are load-restricted or in poor condition, Main said. Every dollar we invest in those bridges, we get back more, almost $5 back. That economic return comes from shorter travel times, less wear on vehicles, and lower fuel costs. Governor Pritzker announced a $50.6 billion six-year infrastructure plan on October 1, 2025, the largest in state history, which includes $32.5 billion for state roads and bridges. Without those repairs, farmers face significant drawbacks in getting their beans to market. The gap in Illinois is widening. Demand for soy milk and tofu is growing. Phoenix Bean is currently expanding its USDA-certified organic soybean products from Whole Foods shelves in the Midwest and Northeast to Sprout shelves in California, distributing nationwide. It's very difficult to find an organic farmer, Yang said. Yet O'Connor and other Illinois farmers are turning away from fast-growing food-grade soybeans. When we're planting a crop here, we're trying to decide which crop we're going to lose the least money on, said Meyer. For him, farming is more than a business. The farm is a member of the family. It's been here for generations. He emphasized that farming practices have improved dramatically, but the economic pressure remains. Until food-grade prices rise significantly, most farmers will stick with commodity soybeans. For Harper, the local food infrastructure grant is a long-term investment, not a quick fix. The program's $3.6 million dollars is a fraction of what is needed. Food prices are rising across Illinois, and investing in local food infrastructure is essential, she said. But we are still far away from actual investment and implementation. Temporary relief for Illinois soybean farmers is scarce. The gap between what Illinois grows and what Illinois eats remains wide. Shifting Illinois soybean production toward the domestic food market seems difficult in the short term. The question lingers, can Illinois feed itself on its own soybeans? You have to start somewhere, Harper said. Tara's son is a graduate student in journalism with the Northwestern University's Medill School of Journalism, Media and Integrated Marketing Communications, and is a fellow in Medill Illinois News Bureau working in partnership with Capital News Illinois, which is where this article came from. This next front page article, RFK Jr. touts health, food, and reading for tots by Amanda Seitz. The little boy dressed in a Toy Story sweatshirt wrapped himself around the nation's health secretary. What do you guys want to be when you grow up? Health and Human Services Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. asked a carpet full of preschoolers. A dinosaur, the boy replied, squeezing tighter. Just weeks ago, Kennedy sat before lawmakers on Capitol Hill and faced intense questions about a dangerous uptick in infectious diseases among American children. Now, with midterm primaries underway, Kennedy was seated in a toddler-sized chair in Ohio on a mission to change the subject. Advised to stay away from the anti-vaccine rhetoric that rocketed him to political stardom, Kennedy has been dispatched by the White House to evangelize about the least controversial and most popular parts of his agenda. Republicans hope Kennedy's Take Back Your Health tour will help them hang on to voters, many of whom are deeply unhappy with President Donald Trump. So there Kennedy was in early May, crisscrossing a strip of northern Ohio that includes one of the few congressional districts that Republicans are confident they can flip in November. He inspected the kitchen of a Toledo daycare center, where hundreds of the city's tiniest residents learn and play through the federally funded Head Start program. Under the careful watch of a surgeon, he briefly operated the renowned Cleveland Clinic's robotic hands on a live patient splayed open for heart surgery. And he munched on a pesticide-free squash blossoms from a 400-acre farm. "I am dismantling a corrupt system and replacing it with something better. Replacing it with something that actually addresses the declining healthy American population," Kennedy said from the dining room table of a farmhouse during an exclusive interview with KFF Health News. He pointed to what he views as his biggest accomplishments over the past year: pressuring some companies to remove dyes from certain foods, updating nutritional guidance, and defining ultra-processed foods. "People are paying attention to what they eat, and the industry is listening. The industry is changing." But hundreds of miles from Washington's partisan interrogations, Kennedy couldn't escape the uncomfortable contradictions and consequences of Trump's administration policies. Classrooms of the Clever Bee Academy displayed freshly printed posters featuring Kennedy's Eat Real Food slogan and the redesigned food pyramid. Kennedy came with an offering, a $30,000 federal grant to help the center upgrade its kitchen and community garden. Perched in front of staff and parents, he distanced himself from a White House push last year that could have been devastating to many of Clever Bee's young students, most of whom live in poverty. The proposal to eliminate the $12 billion Head Start program. "We were asked to cut our agency substantially," Kennedy said. "The two programs that I went to the wall to protect and find the money somewhere else was the Indian Health Services, which is always starved for funding, and Head Start." The next day, Kennedy stood before goats on a farm in Medina, Ohio, cared for by people sobering up from drug or alcohol misuse at the Hope Recovery Community. He was there to promise more investments from an administration that has steeply cut staff and budgets over the past year. Kennedy, who still attends daily Alcoholics Anonymous meetings to cope with the heroin addiction that gripped him for 14 years, said he hopes to replicate the recovery center's model nationwide, describing it as an essential role of government to make sure those services are there. Rows of beds featuring green and purple microgreens awaited Kennedy at the chef's garden in a Huron, Ohio farm that rejects chemical use in growing its produce. "We are absolutely thrilled that someone at this level of government cares about how food is grown and where it is coming from," said Bob Jones, Jr., a co-owner of the chef's garden. Seeing more farmers produce chemical-free leafy greens has topped the wish list of those who support Kennedy and the Make America Healthy Again movement, and many who back Trump in 2024. But in a move that's threatening to fracture that constituency, Trump has pushed to protect the production of glyphosate, a weed-killing, potentially cancer-causing chemical commonly sprayed on crops and lawns. Some prominent MAHA influencers have suggested that Trump's White House staffers are stopping Kennedy from implementing more aggressive policies on certain issues, including further limiting vaccine use, a notion he dismissed. "To say the White House has tied my hands, the only people who could say that are people who haven't been paying attention for a year," Kennedy said. "President Trump has let me do more than any HHS secretary in history." He added, "The only thing that people in the MAHA movement complain about is the president's glyphosate order." Even with Kennedy under advisement to avoid anti-vaccine rhetoric, the issue found him in Ohio. At a forum in Cleveland, family doctor Patricia Kellner said the best way to prevent hepatitis B is by vaccinating newborns, a recommendation that was dropped under Kennedy. She told Kennedy about treating patients with the disease. "Some of them didn't know because it can be asymptomatic. Some of them found out when they got liver cancer," Kellner said. "So why are you opposed to a birth dose of hepatitis B?" Kennedy responded by suggesting that hepatitis B vaccine was not safe for babies and was necessary only for certain people. Hepatitis B is for high-risk groups like drug addicts or prostitutes or for promiscuous homosexuals, he added, eliciting gasps from the crowds. Public health researchers have warned that dropping the universal hepatitis B recommendation will result in hundreds of new infections in children, costing millions of dollars in additional health care costs. And this third headline on the front page, Iran-U.S. attacks violated ceasefire. Rubio says that mine-laying boats and missile launch sites were targeted. Iran said Tuesday the United States violated a ceasefire after the U.S. conducted what it called defensive strikes in southern Iran, while U.S. Secretary of State Marco Rubio said negotiating a deal to halt the conflict could take a few days. Iran's foreign ministry said U.S. strikes in Iran's southern Hormozgan province, where Iranian media reported sounds of explosions early on Tuesday, represented a gross violation of a tenuous ceasefire in place for nearly 7 weeks. Both sides previously indicated progress on a memorandum of understanding that could halt the war and restart shipping through the blockaded Strait of Hormuz, while giving negotiators 60 days to negotiate more complex issues, including Iran's nuclear program. Iranian media reported that Iran's negotiators pushed for the memorandum to include the release of billions of frozen assets at talks in Qatar. Following strikes against targets that the U.S. said included boats attempting to lay mines and missile launch sites, Rubio told reporters on his plane in India's Jaipur that the Strait of Hormuz had to be open one way or the other. The war, which began with the U.S. and Israeli strikes on Iran on February 28th, caused an unprecedented oil supply shock, pushing up the costs of fuel, fertilizer, and food. Iran responded to the strikes by launching drones and missiles at Gulf states that host U.S. bases. Traffic through the Strait of Hormuz, which normally carries about a fifth of the global trade in oil and liquefied natural gas, has been a fraction of its usual level since the war began. Global benchmark Brent crude rose about 3.5% on Tuesday to more than $99 a barrel after news of the U.S. strikes. U.S. Central Command said late on Monday it carried out the first strikes designed to protect our troops from threats posed by Iranian forces. Iran's Revolutionary Guard said Tuesday they reserve the right to retaliate. They said air defense units downed a U.S. drone and fired at another drone and a fighter jet, which they said entered Iranian airspace over the Gulf region. In comments posted on his Telegram channel on the occasion of the annual Hajj pilgrimage, Iran's supreme leader Ayatollah Mojtabi Khamenei said, "The clock cannot be turned back, and the nations and lands of the region will no longer be a shield for American bases." From now on, the slogans "Death to America" and "Death to Israel" will be the slogans of the Islamic nation and the oppressed people of the world, especially the youth, he added. U.S. President Donald Trump previously cited the slogans by justifying military action against Iran. Trump said talks with Iran were going nicely in a lengthy post on Truth Social on Monday, but warned of attacks if they failed. "It will only be a great deal for all or no deal at all," he wrote. Iranian and U.S. officials have indicated that recent indirect talks made progress on a memorandum of understanding or initial deal that would lead to further negotiations over a final agreement. Iran's top negotiator, Mohammad Bakir Khalabaf, its foreign minister, and its central bank governor were in Doha on Monday for talks with Qatar's prime minister on a potential deal, an official briefed on the visit said. Khalabaf returned to Iran after seeking agreement on the release of around $24 billion of frozen Iranian funds as part of the memorandum of understanding, Iranian media reported. Iran's Fars news agency cited a source saying that the unfreezing of the funds was the last serious sticking point for the memorandum of understanding to be finalized. According to Iranian sources, an initial deal would cover ending the war on all fronts, establishing a 30-day framework for restarting movement through the Strait of Hormuz and possibly providing some financial relief, with more complex issues such as Iran's nuclear program to be negotiated in the second phase. Iran is letting some ships through the strait, giving preference to vessels linked to countries with which it has alliances or close ties, and striking government-to-government agreements, Reuters has reported. Trump says his key aim in the war is to prevent Iran from developing a nuclear weapon with its highly enriched uranium. Tehran denies any such plans. Trump also used the crisis to call on more Arab and Muslim states, including Saudi Arabia, to sign up to the Abraham Accords, brokered during his first term in office and aimed at normalizing ties between those states and Israel. Saudi Arabia's long-standing position is that it would not sign those accords unless there is an agreement on a roadmap to Palestinian statehood. As part of any initial deal over the war, Iran wants a stop to the conflict in Lebanon, where a mid-April ceasefire failed to halt fighting between Israel and Iran-backed militant group Hezbollah. After a warning of escalated strikes, Israeli forces expanded their operations in southern Lebanon, Israeli media reported on Tuesday. Thousands have been killed in the wider conflict, mostly in Lebanon and Iran. Inside Iran, internet monitoring group NetBlox reported a partial restoration of connectivity after a near 90-day blackout. Now on page A3, child endangerment alleged, cops. Boy 6 sheltered by Good Samaritan after found wandering in the street, by Tony Reed. A 20-year-old Decatur woman is facing child endangerment charges after her 6-year-old brother, barefoot and wearing only a red shirt and a diaper, was left to wander alone through 4 lanes of traffic. Police also praised a store employee who took charge of the child and helped keep him safe after the child walked into the one-stop market in the 1900 block of North Jasper Street looking for candy. The child went into the store and wanted to get candy, but then left the store, said Sergeant Brandon Rolfs with the Decatur Police Department. But a Good Samaritan, an employee of that little corner store, contacted police and helped keep the child safe so he wouldn't get hit by traffic, Rolfs added, also noting that other people had come to the child's aid. We're grateful we had multiple Good Samaritans who stepped in to protect the child from harm. Rolf said the drama unfolded around lunchtime Sunday when the child was supposed to be being cared for by his big sister, who has a 1-month-old baby of her own and was also watching her younger sister, age 5. The baby and the 5-year-old were both found safe at a house in the 1200 block of East Olive Street. When officers made contact with her, the woman claimed the boy must have snuck out of the house when she was changing loads of laundry, said Rolfs. And she also claimed that she tried to ask a neighbor to look at his surveillance camera to try and figure out where the boy went, instead of calling police right away. Upon further investigation and interview, the woman admitted that she lied to the police about doing laundry and then claimed she fell asleep and woke up almost 2 hours later, and that was when she realized her younger brother had left the house. She said she walked around the neighborhood but was not able to find him. The woman was issued a notice to appear in court on a preliminary charge of endangering the life or health of a child. Rolfs said the Department of Children and Family Services has been alerted to what happened. All preliminary charges are subject to the review by the Office of the State's Attorney. This next article, World War II vet soars for wreath drop, and it's accompanied by a photograph of World War II veteran Earl Estes, who is 101, from Toledo. He's in a helicopter at the Coles County Memorial Airport, getting ready to be flown to Lake Mattoon to drop a wreath into the waters as part of the Memorial Day ceremony there. It almost looks like he's driving it, but he's sitting there in the helicopter. World War II Vets, Mattoon, by Rod Stroud. Earl Estes flew 35 combat missions over Europe while serving as a belly gunner on a B-24 bomber during World War II. The 101-year-old Toledo veteran took flight again on Monday, riding as a passenger in a helicopter and dropping a wreath into the waters of Lake Mattoon for the annual Memorial Day ceremony there. The helicopter was provided once again by the Mattoon Base Rural King. Estes was accompanied in the helicopter by his grandson, Stephen Stanley of Mattoon. Other family members gathered at the Lake Mattoon beach and pavilion to watch him drop the wreath. The Mattoon VFW held this year's Lake Mattoon ceremony. VFW bugler Norm Massey, a Navy veteran, said he met Estes more than 25 years ago through a pinochle group at Immaculate Conception Catholic Church in Mattoon and has been friends with him ever since. He is really looking forward to this flight, Massey said of his friend. Massey said Estes still regularly plays bingo at the VFW and eats lunch at the depot in Mattoon. Massey said he's always amazed by the 101-year-old veteran's vitality and memory, including of the stories he tells of his service in World War II. Chicks hatch from an artificial egg. U.S. company aims to revive an extinct species, by Will Dunham. A U.S. company said that more than 24 healthy baby chickens have hatched from an artificial egg platform that it has developed in what it calls a pivotal step in its plan to bring back to the South Island giant moa, a large flightless bird from New Zealand that went extinct centuries ago. Last week's announcement by Colossal Biosciences, a company dedicated to de-extinction, resurrecting vanished species. The moa is one of two birds, the dodo being the other, among the six species in its portfolio to revive, guided by ancient DNA. The company said last year that it had genetically engineered the dire wolf, an extinct Ice Age predator. Using our system, we have hatched 26 chicks, and we are now actively monitoring these birds as they grow up, Colossal CEO and co-founder Ben Lamb told Reuters. The chicks hatched at Colossal Dallas's headquarters, Lamb said. The artificial egg platform involves a bioengineered silicone-based membranes placed inside a rigid outer structure. The membrane was made to mimic an eggshell's gas exchange function, permitting the embryonic bird to breathe oxygen by regulating the movement of gases and moisture. The technology is designed to closely replicate the conditions of a natural egg to produce healthy animals with normal development, fertility, and longevity. This is especially important for species like the moa, whose eggs were far larger than those of any living bird, making traditional surrogate approaches impractical, Lamb said. Through cloning, embryos in the dire wolf project were created from edited gray wolf cells, and those were implanted in surrogate domesticated dog mothers. But no extant avian species is sufficiently large enough to lay a South Island giant moa egg about the size of a soccer ball. The moa, which stood up to 12 feet tall, went extinct roughly 500 years ago, largely due to hunting by people. The emu, a large flightless bird from Australia that can reach about 6 feet tall, is its closest living relative. In order to hatch a South Island giant moa, Colossal needs a way to gestate the embryo. There is no living surrogate large enough to lay a South Island moa egg, as they are around 8 times larger than an emu egg, Lamb said. Lamb described how the artificial egg process works. The process begins with a fertilized avian embryo, similar to the earliest stages of development inside a natural egg. The embryo and yolk are then transferred into Colossal's artificial egg platform, which is designed to replicate the key functions of a natural eggshell and incubation environment, including gas exchange, moisture regulation, temperature stability, and developmental support, Lamb said. Prepping for the polls. Ahead of midterms, administrators boost training for the FBI and National Guard scenarios by Sarah DeWire. Scott McDowell's training slideshow for poll workers covers what to do in case of fire or flood. A few years ago, the clerk for Dane County, which includes Madison and is Wisconsin's second most populous county, added de-escalation training in case a voter became aggressive. The Democrat said he is adding a new slide this year, what to do if the FBI shows up at your office and what not to do. He isn't the only one. Multiple election officials told USA Today they were preparing in case the federal government interferes in the midterm elections. Ahead of every local and state election, officials spend months planning for a variety of emergency scenarios and plotting out in detail how they will respond. This can include changing routes to get ballots to the counting location if there is traffic on election night, sending replacement machines to a polling location if some stop working, and safeguarding ballots if there's a flood or a fire. Local police, fire departments, and emergency management teams are involved. President Donald Trump's threats of federal involvement in the midterm elections alarmed many of the nation's thousands of election officials. For the first time, they are factoring in what they will do if National Guard troops or immigration officials are sent to polling sites, if federal agents demand access to ballots or election machines, or if the U.S. Postal Service stops delivering ballots once the polls close, regardless of state law. The Trump administration placed 2020 election deniers in powerful positions, attempted to seize election materials in several swing states, and threatened to send federal authorities to polling locations. Kim Pulteski, the clerk for Oconto County, Wisconsin, doesn't expect such rural areas to be targeted, but if it is, the Republican wants poll workers to welcome federal authorities in and treat them like election observers, and then those workers should call her, she said. If the FBI were to show up with a warrant for election machines, Pulteski said, it would give me pause. Obviously, I'm not going to defy a warrant, but you'd be sure I'd be going with them. Trump also signed two executive orders that would give the administration unprecedented control over who can vote. One would require identification to vote nationwide. It was blocked by multiple courts, and the administration is appealing. The second instructed the Postal Service to refuse to deliver ballots to anyone not on a newly created federal list of registered voters. State and voting rights groups sued. McDonnell, meanwhile, has prepared by consulting attorneys who have experience with election cases and the federal courthouse. Okay, that's all we have for part one. I'll be back with part two shortly.